Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Naoki Takahashi, a Japanese restaurant in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Why Food Podcast, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and creatives who have left a former career to pursue lives in the food, beverage, and hospitality industry. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Fritsch.
Today, we're joined by Mohammed Moderis, who is the founder of Abe's Meats, the only halal and kosher meat company in the U.S. Please join us.
Yes, yes. Salam, shalom. What's up? Yeah, how's it going, guys?
All the things.
All of the things.
So what's the story? Why are you the only halal and kosher meat company in the country?
Oh boy. It started, the idea came about after, the election cycle, the last election cycle, the type of rhetoric that was coming out against, Muslims, Jews, felt like everyone, mm-hmm. And I had, at that time, a history in Northern California of just hosting different types of charity events. And I wanted to bring my Muslim friends, my Jewish friends together, really everyone, to have an interfaith dinner. And then I began having conversations with different people who wanted to come. And, you know, they asked me about kosher dietary laws and halal needs, and that's when I, you know, got into this world. And I thought, to have the most inclusive dinner table, you know, I have to respect everyone's religious dietary laws. Sure enough, that took me on a kind of a long-winded way of hosting our first Shabbat Salam dinner a few months after. And it was because I wanted to go to different religious leaders and food experts, asking them if I can bring the whole on kosher process together, because having both, respecting both, but having them separate, I felt was just not only, you know, odd, but really expensive. And logistically, just not possible for, you know, the type of space that I had. And I was just also really curious. I mean, this was something to me that, you know, I thought it should change. So it was fun. I mean, I just went up and down the Pacific Coast. And sure enough, ended up meeting a shochet, who is a Jewish leader who oversees the kosher process, and I brought on his Muslim equivalent, and we produced what we called interfaith meat that day. And yeah, since then, we've been offering it at our Shabbat Salam dinners around the country.
So can we do a quick debrief on the... I know there's a lot of laws that go into both kosher and halal. Yeah. So can we do a quick discussion on what that entails and who you have to get involved?
Absolutely. So a lot of times, kosher is... Well, we'll start with kosher. Kosher is followed by the Jewish community. It requires, for meat production, for dairy, for par... You know, each class has its own thing. And for myself, considering where we do meat production, it means from start to finish having oversight by a Jewish leader who follows a certain steps. For the meat production itself, it means a shochet is involved. They do a horizontal cut on the animal. In the case of if it's large production. There's something that's said. It could be said one time. Then afterwards, to follow gluck kosher, which is a little bit more orthodox, they then have to open up the animal and make sure that it's there's no lesions on the lungs, that the animal hasn't been abused in any way, that the health of the animal is adequate. And in the production process, it's actually done next to, when I've gone to these facilities, it's done with USDA oversight. And so, you know, after the sacrifice of the animal, after the animal's broken down, they, you know, look through different parts of the animal and they say, all right, this gets that stamp, and it follows through this process. I actually, now over this last year and a half of seeing all of this, I very much respect the thought process and just the focus to detail that gluck kosher has. Now, in regards to its relationship with the actual faith-based dietary laws, you know, a lot of it is people go back and forth regarding the interpretation of it. So gluck kosher is actually fairly new. It's you know, roughly been in practice for less than 200 years. And so when we talk about kosher itself, or the laws of kashrut, that's a little bit older, and those steps are less. I mean, in these religious laws or even the oral teachings, it talks about the types of animals you can't consume, but it doesn't go into the details of the actual food production. So these are things that have developed over time, culturally, for hygiene purposes, for cultural purposes, and even to a certain extent within the Jewish Muslim community, to create a sense of, you know, this is our way of doing it, and attaching it to the cultural and traditional values of particular societies, which as people, as humans, we do that all the time, right? I mean, you know, we, the history of, I don't know, any type of cuisine, we bring it back to the origins mm-hmm. of its country and its people. So that, I found that incredibly fascinating, and then kind of going and seeing how halal does it. But one thing that, as I stepped more and more into this world, what I wanted to make sure that I did was be true to my understanding of public health and environmental health. And what I mean by that is kosher certification, halal certification, you could go and produce meat in a factory farm, facility from an industrialized, you know, with an industrialized mindset, and still get a religious certification. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a disconnect there between, the old way of thinking to now the new way of thinking, to just how the market's also evolving. I think fortunately now customers are wanting better quality food. And so as a result, you know, you have that, you have these different types of ecosystems opening up and wanting to service these communities. And I expect that the faith-based communities will follow that. And it's exciting to see that, but still from a religious standpoint, or from religious certification standpoint, excuse me, there isn't a particular, you know, added steps or what have you. And so for us, I was like, all right, like, you know, I already have a particular relationship with meat. I'm a flexitarian. I don't go and, you know, consume it all the time or what have you. So, you know, I'm trying to be conscious of going down this step and making sure that we're a food brand. Really, we're an interfaith organization that is using food as a tool to promote inclusivity, to promote cultural understanding between the Muslim and Jewish world. And in this case, it happened. It evolved to now become what we know as interfaith meat. And so our first step was, okay, you know, let's take into consideration regenerative agriculture. Let's apply that into this process. Let's make sure that the cattle we bring on to produce as meat, that they're grass-fed, but not only are they grass-fed, they're grass-finished, that they have lived in humane conditions until they reach the facility, and when they reach the facility, that it's sacrificed in an appropriate way. And within the Muslim Jewish community, there's a lot of controversy around stunning or not. We don't do stunning because that's what's accepted within the Muslim Jewish communities. That's what they can agree on. And then even afterwards, the packaging process, the fulfillment process, that it's done with oversight that's appropriate, which includes salting and, you know, making sure that different fats and veins and whatnot are taken out. So it's kind of a long supply chain, but we want to follow the most orthodox forms of both faiths so that it becomes a common denominator. And that's where kind of the term came of interfaith meat.
Were there slaughterhouses already set up to do this work to begin with, or did you have to convince them? What was the process like when you went into a slaughterhouse and said, I want this to be certified in both faiths?
Mm-hmm.
How did you make that happen?
Yeah, there's already facilities that have applied kosher standards. And so, for example, the one that we work with in Maryland, they were more than happy to comply with the steps that we wanted to apply the halal process with kosher, because they're considering how the meat industry is going. Like, they want to make sure that they, it's a facility. They want business, right? And so if they can bring in now the needs of the Muslim community, which is halal dietary requirements, which have grown about a third since 2010. Halal is now very, from a meat standpoint, meat production standpoint, it's now fairly comparable to kosher. Kosher certification is much bigger than halal right now in the United States, but that will likely change because of just the rising immigrant Muslim community and just the Muslim diaspora, and also the level of faith and interest in these dietary laws. You have more of the Jewish community in this country becoming secular, and those who apply, you know, kosher requirements, a lot of it becoming cultural. And so in this case, this facility was just like, oh, this is cool, but didn't really go into it. Yeah, there's like, okay, so you know, you're gonna give me the Muslim community involved, great, and really wonderful people at this facility up in Maryland. Truths, they do great work.
You also mentioned that earlier at lunch that there's a lot of waste reduction by being able to carry out this process simultaneously.
Sure.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, kosher is very strict, especially the glut kosher process, and only the front half of an animal is kosher. It's from the 13th rib up, if I'm not mistaken. And so the back hind, because of a particular vein that goes, deems the back hind of the animal not kosher. Now, there are certain kosher certifiers, I believe most of them are Sephardic, that will say, like, look, that back hind is okay, but if you want it to be done this way, excuse me, this vein has to be taken out, etc. And that becomes very time intensive and just labor intensive for any you know, meat company. And in our case, the beauty of it is that front half of the animal is halal and kosher, becomes glut kosher and zabiya halal, the most orthodox forms of it. But that back hind now doesn't go to waste either, because it's still zabiya halal. For Muslims, that particular dietary law just doesn't comply. For Muslims, the importance of making sure that the animal is raised properly is of great concern. And then, of course, for both faiths, making sure that there is as possible amount of blood as possible for the animal. So that's where the salting process comes in, which it's very fascinating to me because as a Muslim, I had never been part of the salting process. And now I'm just like, well, Muslims should be doing that too. But it makes sense that they don't, because when you think about all of these steps, it's from a long time ago. I mean, the reason why the salting happens is also because of refrigeration.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it's not necessarily like this is what God said. This is because of, you know, just the infrastructure that existed. So, you know, it's nice to see that. It's nice to see that you know, part of it continues. But yeah, for myself, it's just making sure that from start to finish, that we make sure that the supply chain not only follows the religious dietary laws, but also follows an ecological perspective that I hope will begin to become more and more popular within these religious communities. And it's definitely a topic of discussion. I know, Hazan, an organization, a Jewish organization, recently gave some grants to different types of Jewish food companies to begin thinking more this way and producing food in this manner. So, you know, they're definitely thinking about it and applying it in different ways, which is great to hear and great to see.
Can you also walk us through a little bit about now that you've gone through what is a pretty rigorous function and processes, the actual certification? So you're kosher certified, and you're going to be halal certified. Is that different? How is it different from an organic label or, you know, the other things that you might see on your meat?
Yeah, well, I'm curious for the organic label process, because for kosher, I would say the largest certifiers, first of all, are OU. If you look on, you know, 40% of your products today, just I'm sure you can go to your kitchen and grab something and, you know, look on the label, you'll probably find an OU label, which is Orthodox Union, or Star K, which is a K inside a star. And they require oversight across the process. And as a result, you know, especially if you're doing Galut kosher, it becomes fairly expensive. Each of these certifications, not even just for meat, but generally for products, it could run you upwards of, you know, $5,000-$6,000 a SKU, which is, you know, that's a lot of money.
Especially for a small new company.
A small new company, yeah. And so now there are some that will go and team up with others, you know, and work with each other and bring on a shochet and divide that cost and whatnot, especially if there's very low production. Within this facility, this particular facility is interesting because it not only has Star K representatives, but also OU representatives. And, you know, as you can imagine, within any... I mean, they come on different days and they respect each other's process. And,
that's very diplomatic.
Very diplomatic, yes. They have their own ways. And, within halal certification, halal, because it's not, their infrastructure is not built, as you know, as well as koshers in the United States. Globally, that's a completely different matter. I mean, globally, there's you know, now close to like 2 billion Muslims, and nowhere near as many Jews around the world. So the halal infrastructure in places like Malaysia, in places like the Middle East, I mean, it's pretty grand. But
when I lived in Afghanistan, there used to be halal chickens raised and killed in Brazil and frozen and shipped. You'd go to the supermarket in Kabul and you would buy halal chickens that were imported from Brazil into Afghanistan.
Why didn't they just kill their own chicken?
Well, I mean, you could, if you wanted to kill your own chicken, and you could, but if you were getting the kind of industrial meat supply chain, for whatever reason, they were being slaughtered in Brazil and frozen and shipped to Afghanistan.
Yeah, and Brazil is actually the number one exporter of halal meat.
Really?
Which is crazy.
Do they have a large Muslim population?
No, it's just this is business for the beef industry that does, I should just say in general, you know, animal-based meats in Brazil. But another fun fact, there's over 2,000 kosher facilities in China.
Really?
You know, not just, we're not talking about meat, but like even spices and, you know, different types of ingredients and whatnot. So kosher, halal, it's not just, you know, a stamp. There's a immense investment and infrastructure behind it. In the United States, roughly 40% of foods are kosher, CPGs are kosher, and it goes beyond just the Jewish population. I mean, it's the Jewish population in America is roughly 1%. So for 40% of foods to be labeled as such is, you know, you would think that doesn't make sense, But now, kosher is also seen as a label that accounts for, you know, more. It's seen as an extra pair of eyes.
Mm-hmm. Quality.
It stands for now. This is you know, it stands for this. Whether or not it is that, that's a completely different discussion. It's based on the company. It's based on a lot of other stuff. But then it brings up that conversation again of the relationship with the environment. Because is it more, you know, ecological or is it more economically viable to ship that piece of meat from Brazil to Afghanistan? Sure, because of the infrastructure that, you know, the meat production process in Afghanistan. But is it more ecologically viable? Now we can, you know, have a conversation of where we want the kosher community, the halal community, excuse me, certifications to go into. And I know there's some, you know, kosher certifiers that are applying that more and more. I think there's one called Earth Kosher. And that's, you know, becoming more of an interest to people who comply with kosher laws. And within the Muslim community, it's still, I would say, regional. So you have different certifiers who have a bigger presence, maybe in Chicago or in California, or New York, or what have you. But applying that aspect or that perspective of the environment, you know, I look forward to working with certifiers and making sure that that's applied for us, whether or not it's certified or, you know, not. That's just such a big, you know, component to our organization.
Have you come across other tensions either between the halal and kosher, either your customer bases or communities at large, judgments or issues that they feel like are not being met? Are there tensions between kosher and halal? And then are there internal tensions on the halal side?
I would say the biggest tension within halal is actually this environmental perspective. More people are now just deciding to eat grass-fed, maybe even grass-fed, grass-finished versus going after halal meat because they're realizing that this factory farm approach, it has caused it to just, I mean, not only be damaging for the environment, but also offer low quality food. So the conversations that I'm having, you know, is like, this is a very quick way of you separating yourself from the competition that exists. I mean, it's very daunting actually for us. We're a very, very small company, but that said, because of the fact that like from day one, we decided to follow regenerative agriculture. Now there's an interest of like, okay, this is not only halal based on, you know, label, but this is halal based on this approach, which was and still, you know, is very important within anybody who wants to follow this dietary law, especially for Muslims.
And you've also had some issues personally, right?
Like
what are some of the reactions that you've gotten based on your background?
It's just as an Iranian Muslim, you know, I've been in the pursuit of getting halal certification, and you know, because it's regional. So far, of course, there are big names out there and they're doing a great job becoming more and more of a national provider. But I wanted my certifier and oversight to be close to me. So contacted a New York halal certifier and, you know, we built quite a long relationship. I mean, it was 4 or 5 months of just chatting and talking about just what it all means, and why we're doing the things that we're doing, why our focus is on the environment so much, and this person who I, you know, had built this relationship with also had the same name as one of my Iranian friends. And just this one day, you know, he calls me up and I'm thinking it's my Iranian friend. I pick up the phone and I just start talking to him in Persian, laughing and joking a little bit. And I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was you and whatnot. And we go back to talking about, you know, the certification process and what I need to do to have one of his colleagues there at our facility. And then at the end of the conversation, brings it back up. It's like, hey, I'm just curious. And you know, Iranians predominantly are most of them are Shia Muslim, and Shias are—they're roughly 10-12% of the global Muslim population. Majority are Sunni Muslims. I grew up in an environment where, you know, my friends were Jewish, Muslim. We never even said Sunni or Shia, what have you. But for him, apparently, this had of significant value, despite the fact that for months before he had not only agreed with me on the steps that we had taken, but commended me for, you know, the ecological components and even the economic components, because we're purchasing from local farmers, ranchers, etc. And so his, you know, he's curious. And he asked me, "Are you Shia or are you Muslim?" And
there was no modifier to the latter Muslim, I see.
And so, you know, to denounce a denomination and to put that in front of everything that we've done, it was surprising to me. And I never even, you know, he still doesn't know, right? He didn't get an answer to his question. But just respectfully, you know, just said, you know, have a nice day and all that good stuff. And
have you experienced that before ever?
Well, I mean, the thing is within, sure, I mean, I've experienced different types of discrimination within Islam or just as a Muslim in America. I mean, that's how this kind of all started to a certain respect. You know, I post 9/11, how I felt as a kid, you know, seeing the environment that changed. I grew up in the tri-state area. So, you know, being in New Jersey, being in a suburb in New Jersey, and then how people reacted to any Muslim in that environment. I mean, I was physically, you know, assaulted, but not only that, my mother was punched in a mall after 9/11. And so, like, you know, you kind of, that's in the back of your mind. And fast forward to the election cycle, after the 2016 elections, when this type of narrative is built around Muslims, around Jews, it didn't take much for me to be like, all right, now I'm an adult. Let me try to figure out how to do something here. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what. I didn't know I was going to go into halal kosher foods, but I thought, all right, let me organize an interfaith dinner and bring my Muslim and Jewish friends together, and let's talk about this. Let's see what we can do, what we can put into action, how to measure this bigotry, how to combat this bigotry, and then, yeah, having to put that Shabbat Salam dinner on hold to run around and see if we can make interfaith meet. And then that's how this all started. And sure enough, like, having the dinners now, it's really, the meat does become, to a certain extent, the centerpiece. Because when people realize that, oh, wait a second, like, kosher and halal can come together. So, like, what else, if we look back through our history, can we merge to celebrate our, you know, our identities? And it's kind of cool, because then, like, we went into just merging different stuff, and that's kind of what Interfaith Ventures is. You know, at the end of the day, it's kind of like an incubator to create these products and programs for promoting interfaith unity. And Abe's Meats, we see that as, like, underneath that umbrella.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Mohammed Madaris, and we're going to go through some of the interesting and complicated career shifts that he's made to get to this point. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Naoki Takahashi, a restaurant in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan. When you dine at Naoki Takahashi, you'll feel like you've been transported to Japan. Sample a little bit of everything with kaiseki menus, or let Chef Naoki lead the way with his omakase menu. A la carte and vegetarian dishes are also available. Learn more at naokitakahashi.com. That's NAOKITAKAHASHI.com. You can
rewind, erase, forget my face, and the song that's hidden. And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, creatives. I feel like every time we give this description, we add a new category to the list. Anybody who did anything and now works in food. We're here with Mohammed Madaris, who's the founder of Abe's Meats, the country's first and only, is that right? Mm-hmm. Only kosher and halal meat company. The first half of the podcast, we talked a lot about the kosher and halal certifications and some of the processes and politics and changing trends around that. So in the second half, we're going to pivot a little bit and talk more about your career, your personal story, and all of the experiences that have led you to this point.
Because you have a bit of a political background as well.
So yeah, tell us about your you've had like 12 mini careers. So let's run through them. Tell us about your career as a political cartoonist.
Yeah, it started off, I was very young. I was in elementary school.
The normal time that people start careers.
We're chasing that paper as a six-year-old now. Started drawing, started illustrating. And I mean, it's maybe important to say that my parents were also, being of a Persian background, Iranian background, maybe actually another side note. I'm just going to go into multiple side notes here. My last name, Madaris, means actually teacher. And we actually have 42 generations of teachers.
Oh, wow. Family.
The only reason why we know that is because teachers would record that information. And so within our family, there was this respect for not only just science and mathematics and ultimately becoming a doctor, an engineer, lawyer, you know, like that whole conversation, which I know a lot of Asian communities have, but then also this respect for poetry and the arts. So I was always, you know, encouraged to express myself using anything that I had, as long as I had, you know, nothing short of an A in math class or whatnot. So I started illustrating when I was in elementary school, and sure enough, I had some great teachers along the way who would push me to throw some stuff into competitions and whatnot. And sure enough, when I realized that, oh, I can win these competitions, and at the same time, you know, beginning to read more than just the cartoon section of a newspaper, I wanted to express, you know, the concerns that I had about the environment or about a political situation or about, you know, anything that I found as unjust. And so one of the illustrations was about, you know, 9/11, or one was about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Pretty heavy stuff. But at the same time, I would draw stuff about, you know, don't cut trees. Or in the case of this poster that got me, you know, a year's worth of toilet paper, it was don't cut down trees, please. And it just led into this world that I didn't know existed until I started publishing, you know, even for Newsweek and ultimately for New York Times, which was a great honor. But also just giving me a higher level of visual literacy as I got older, to appreciate and to understand and critically think about what not just other illustrators are trying to say, but then what other writers and different types of artists are trying to express with their work.
And how old were you when the New York Times published your cartoon?
I was about 11. Yeah, it was the 9/11 piece was pretty powerful. It got published on September 13th, and a lot of you know, at that time, mail or email would come at me, and some that were just, you know, great piece, others that were like, you know, I've ripped it from the paper, and I have it on my refrigerator. Wow. And it's helped me recover over the years. And this type of mail actually, it continues to come, which is crazy, but now it comes roughly every year around the anniversary. And I felt, especially after the creating that piece, that this was obviously something beyond myself. This was beyond my perspective and whatnot. This needs to be given to the community at large. And so sure enough, I mean, there were opportunities to sell the piece, to, you know, sell the rights and whatnot, and those offers were made by newspapers and whatnot, that I just it didn't make me feel good. And so ultimately, I donated it to different collections. It kind of like moved around to different collections, and was most recently donated to actually the 9/11 Museum, which was, I think, the right place to leave it at that.
What compelled you? I mean, kids draw, that's fairly common, but to, first of all, take on a topic as political and intense, and especially to do it in the day, you must have drawn that the day after 9/11 for it to be then in the paper by the 13th. Mm-hmm. What compelled you to deal with such an intense topic and to do it so quickly?
Yeah, at that time, just drawing was my way of expressing everything. I wasn't particularly good at speaking. I don't think I am serious still. You know, and now I do a lot more writing than I do illustrating. But yeah, at that time, that's what I was doing. I would do when I had roughly around the same time, I also did a piece around Columbine, and that actually won me a stereo system by Panasonic.
Something a little backwards about that.
yeah, very weird. It was a competition that was sponsored by Panasonic and I think Star Ledger at the time. And sure enough, Panasonic thought, here you go, kid.
That's the perfect response.
A six CD changer, like boombox, and never used it. That's how I would express myself. And it was, and, you know, growing up, having the opportunity to do that, because I realized, especially at that age, there were kids around me who wanted to say a lot of the things that I was saying, but they just didn't know how. Mm-hmm. And you know, for nowadays, I mean, gosh, these, now I feel very old saying this, but like kids these days, you know, they seem to really know how to express themselves. And a lot of the kids that I saw at the most recent march, I mean, incredible. But the kids around me, I don't know, maybe this is
just New Jersey.
This is just New Jersey, right? But having the luxury to do that was great.
And you eventually parlayed this into a nonprofit as well. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the first nonprofit that I started was called the Peace Project, and it was based around, actually after the 9/11 drawing came out, there was a young lady who turned it into T-shirts, and I thought, okay, well, you know, if you can do that, I'm sure I can turn these illustrations that I produce into different types of products, and whatever is sold, we can give it back to, you know, different causes that we believe in. And that's how it began. And so it was kind of like, if it actually first started off as just like the type of artwork that I was producing. Excuse me. And this pizza was so good, but it's also just like,
we had some still pizza trying to before process the show, it. As always.
But But after that, it actually turned into more of a fair trade organization. We were exporting products from Peru, thanks to the help of the Peruvian Medical Society. We were exporting products from South Africa and selling them on our little e-commerce store at the time. Gosh, when was this? This was back when Apple used to have their own type of like Squarespace or like their own type of Wix.
What?
I think it was this. Called like the i something, of course, right? But they used to have their own little website builder. And so that was like our first little like e-commerce platform, and we'd sell these earrings from Peru on there and like bracelets and whatnot. And most of the sales would happen during Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know. And
you were Tom's before Tom's.
Shout out to Tom's. I actually remember meeting Kyle for the first time, like, you know, in awe back in, I think it was 2008. Cool guy. And but yeah, it was just, you know, that kind of unfolded. And that's when I started learning more and more about, you know, social entrepreneurship. I didn't know that that's what it was called. I didn't know that there was I just thought that this was volunteering because nobody was making money on it. So, but then, yeah, I got into college, and in Baltimore, Ashoka, which sponsors like social entrepreneurs and whatnot around the world. And they also coined the term social entrepreneurship. That's when I was like, oh, wow, this is what it's called. This is what, you know, you just do. You know, you take these business applications, you put it into, you know, for a social purpose, to create a social enterprise. And so those were the early days of kind of thinking about those things. And that's why ultimately all these, you know, methods and philosophies have a place with Abe's Meats, but also just with a lot of businesses coming out that you guys, I'm sure, have a lot of entrepreneurs that you've spoken to, including your own work.
Right? I guess so. Yeah. And then, so then you went into public health. Right.
Tell us about public health. Yeah, so I actually, I wanted to be an architect growing up. I just thought that was the best fit because, you know, I was fairly good at math. And, you know, I was like, all right, I'm drawing different stuff. People seem to like it, whatnot. And also in the back of my mind, my father always wanted to be an architect. And then the revolution happened in 1979 in Iran, and when he had to leave and he came to the States, and the struggles of you know, just everything that, you know, an immigrant would go through, he wasn't able to you know, finish his degree and become that. And so I kind of, and, you know, I had that just like, yeah, I'm gonna do it for you, Dad. But I realized by the end of high school that everything that I really wanted as a future architect was in public health. And what I mean by that is from, you know, lead in paint to creating and designing a space that is accessible for people who may have any, you know, form of inability, or to, you know, the urban planning of large architectural you know, productions. You know, these things were just, I was like, all right, like, maybe this is what I need to study. So I ended up going to Hopkins, 4 years of grad school, I like to call it. And it was fun. It was challenging. I was lucky enough to really explore outside of the campus. A lot of times a college campus can be a bubble. And that's when I started just really applying and really understanding, and then trying to apply a lot of the issues that were already in Baltimore. But somehow you end up going international with public health a lot of times. I think that that's just the what would you call it? Like, kind of the... there's a certain glow to doing work abroad. You know, it's a new space.
Feels like the problems are easier to solve when they're somebody else's problem. And yeah. You don't, you know, understand the complexity.
Exactly.
And the
you're a kid. You're trying to, you know. And actually, funny enough, when I was in my second year I was like, all right, I want to do some type of study abroad. Like, this is just, and I have an older sister, and, you know, she traveled abroad during her college years, and I was just so much in envy. And I literally spun the globe and put my finger on it, and I ended up on South Africa. And I was like, huh, okay, I know nothing about South African culture. And, you know, by extension of like Middle East, you kind of know a little bit about what you could expect in Northern Africa because of the spread of Islam and what have you, and its cultures that have evolved from the faith. But South Africa, what's in South Africa? And then at the same time, the World Cup was going to be in South Africa, and I was like, all right, you know what? This is looking good. And I ended up there in 2009. And then because I was there in 2009, I ended up actually working with the World Cup team that was doing the public health work around Football for Hope, which is FIFA's like CSR project. And FIFA is all kinds of weird, but with their departments are really separate of each other. And so the leaders of that department really took me under their wings and really showed me what the end result of public health can be, you know, in regards to field work, in regards to research, in regards to just, and using Cape Town as the classroom, using specifically Khayelitsha Township as the classroom. So I kind of, after that, I was like, all right, cool, you know, went back. And my last year at Hopkins, it's cool because you get to go from the undergraduate campus to the graduate campus, and now you're feeling like an adult, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. And I always thought that this is, okay, I'm going to be a public health practitioner. That's just the natural evolution of it. And so even when I had the, you know, great honor of being nominated by the university to go abroad and to study in Europe through a scholarship, I still found myself going to, you know, East Africa. I ended up in Rwanda and doing more public health work, but this time around climate change and around soil erosion and learning more and more about, you know, agriculture. And so when I got kind of a call to come to California and move to California and start this other project, It was a tough decision. I was like, all right, cool. And part of my decision for going back was because at that time, my sister ended up in Sierra Leone, and my parents were having enough. They're having enough of this stuff. They were just like, look, one of you has to be back. Like, they saw Sierra Leone and Rwanda as like the same thing, right? And so I was like, all right, like, I just got called. Come to California. All right, like I'll try California. Who knows? I can always go back and continue my work in East Africa. And that's where, you know, coming to California and the next chapter of starting a biotech company, which was as sporadic as it sounds, really. But because of the political climate, then evolving into the work that I do now.
And one of the things that we were talking a little bit over lunch was as Abe's Meats continue, you do want to do more value-added meats and then also move into more plant-based, or maybe plant-based is the wrong word, but more less meat, more plant sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we were talking a little bit about soil erosion and all the agricultural worries around that. Can you talk a little bit about how that's impacted your thinking for the future of the business?
Absolutely. I am a meat company that doesn't want to be a meat company. Personally, myself, I mean, I used to be a vegetarian for a couple of years. Now I'm flexitarian, but and this is why right now the focus on how we source is as important as our, you know, religious observance, and that's why regenerative agriculture is so important to us, particularly in this community, because we see the consumer base as, you know, crickets aren't kosher, you know, lab grown meat it's got a big question mark over it for this particular, you know, Jewish Muslim community. It's the more Orthodox you get, but for us, it's about helping this community become more flexitarian and beginning to understand the environmental impact of food at large. And that doesn't just mean meat, right? That means, I mean, even soy and wheat and corn and what these types of crops do to our pastures and how that affects the environment. The thing about regenerative agriculture is that its basis is about growing carbon soil. It's about making our soil stronger. So, you know, we have a big focus right now on climate change and what climate change is doing, but soil and soil erosion, I would say, is equal to, if not even more concerning, because soil has a lot of carbon in it. And if you use your land properly, that carbon can stay within the soil and build good pasture, and thus produce very good food at a very low carbon footprint. Or you can till and you can, you know, factory farm and industrialize the process, which we have over the past couple of generations perfected. I mean, somehow, some way, we've managed to get that chicken from Brazil to Afghanistan at a lower price point. You know, that's bonkers. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible, but it's also just wrong in many ways. Yeah. So now, like, to go into regenerative agriculture, you know, meat has become synonymous with factory farming, and to a large extent, it should be. Like, it's 99% of the industry is factory farmed. 1% is regenerative. But can we, as consumers, use our purchasing power to make that 1%, 2%, 3%? And at the same time, then begin to value that process and see it not just as, excuse me, as better meat, but as also just better food.
Yeah. Mohammed, it's been a real pleasure having you join us. we're out of time.
I keep going for another two hours.
Yeah. That you've been listening to Why Food Podcast. You can find us at heritageradionetwork.org. Email us whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
And will you tell us where our listeners can find you online at Apes?
Yeah, apesmeats.com, apesmeats.com. Yeah, feel free to follow us and show us some love. Thanks.
And I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch. You can find me via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel, burlapandbarrel.com.
And I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey. You can always find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And please send us questions, thoughts, comments, nominations at Why Food at
Heritage. Yeah, we're booking guests for the summer season starting in May. Wow. So,
dun, dun, dun.
So send us all of your career-changing friends. And thanks to Amanda for being an awesome sound engineer, and to
Blind by the Red Crickets for our theme song.
See you next week.
That's why we ended up like that. All the sick things that we've been through, gotta stop the wasting of my time.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.